This is Angelina Singer, author of the Upper World series, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout, the best podcast for independent artists.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. Great to have you here. I'm your host, Max Bowen.
And as always, it's Curtis Hughes.
Curtis, you have a much better intro than me.
No, I do not. Get out of here.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Well, I will do my best now to intro our next guest. You might remember the name. He is part of our past author Q&A series. We talked about his, at the time, first book, The Scales of Balance. And, well, that was so much fun. We wanted to come back, bring him on the show, talk about his now third book, The Age of End, out on April 16th. Author Tim Fasciola joins me. Tim, welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Welcome. It's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me, guys.
All right. All right. So we are talking about your Vengeful Realm series, which by the way, awesome name for a book series. I love that one.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned earlier, your third book, Age of End, is coming out on April 16th. So at the time of this recording, about a couple weeks away. Without giving any kind of spoilers, though, how does this one wrap the series up?
Writing ends is always hard. And if you're unsure of that, ask George R. R. Martin or ask Patrick Rothfuss. Yeah, I'm calling them out because they were huge inspirations for me. Writing an end is not easy, which was why it was very important to me to actually write all three books before I even released the first book. So in terms of the ending, my biggest thing was I wanted to create a catharsis. So I'm not going to give you any plot points. I'm not going to give you any character things, but thematically I wanted to, like, it's called a vengeful realm. You're going to go through some darkness. But the whole concept that I wanted to really bring readers to at the end was there is a light of hope through this darkness. And that's what I try to encapsulate through the ending of this series, is that, like, it is a hard fought and a well-earned ending. It's not all, you know, happy-go-lucky. It's not all sunshine and rainbows. There is no true happily ever after. But at the same time, I wanted to give a deserved catharsis of, like, yeah, I understand why this had to be this way. And it's hard, but it feels good. That was the resonance I wanted to create, if that makes sense.
It does. And I got to say, from the cover for the soon-to-be-released third book, yeah, it's definitely dark. It's definitely dark. Yeah. This is not a hopeful cover. This is not a, oh, this should be a fun little romp. It's like, nah, shit's getting dark. It's getting dark.
It's going down.
Things are happening.
I mean, with a title like The Age of the End, right? It's probably not going to be like a walk in the park, right?
No. I definitely get the vibe. This is not going to be a fun little romp. But is this your actually last book? Or is it like your last book for now? Because those can be two different things.
Certainly. So it's the last book in this trilogy. So this does wrap it up. This is a very definitive end. There's a couple seedlings that should I decide to nurture and hydrate and give some sunshine to, that, like, there are organic opportunities to jump back into the series, either with a passage of time or, like, I could theoretically pick up right where I left off. I do leave some nuggets. I've talked with my narrator. My narrator is super creative and has really gotten to know these characters over the past year of recording these books. So he's like, oh, I'd love to see, like, a novella of this. I'd love to see. I'm like, you're giving me great ideas, but most in, like, this is in, things are in motion. The prequel that follows one of the primary viewpoint characters throughout the series, there is a prequel that kind of covers her origin story. And the plan for that is to release in January of 2025. That was written to be kind of a standalone. Like, you could just read that book and not read the trilogy. You could read the trilogy and not read that book. But if you decide to read all of them, you could do so in either order and it would still have like a full feel to it. So I'm excited for that to come out. That's called The Ghosts of Rania. And that is probably that is dark.
See, I knew it. I knew it wasn't totally over. You always had those little things that, you know what, this could be a good book. This could be a spinoff. But of course, let us dive into the story of this series. This is all centering under us, centering around your main character, Zephyrus, who is an amnesiac gladiator. There we go. I can say words. With a mysterious prophecy who fights for his freedom, spies on a prince, thwarts the queen's bloodthirsty plot. The usual Sunday, right? You know, pretty like, yeah. You know, regular thing. Now, you spent like 10 years developing a story. I'm kind of picturing you in front of like a parchment with like a quill pen and a candle as you furiously scribe your world, but obviously real life. But what went into developing this over that decade?
So that image is so much more romantic than what it actually was. the reality is, have you ever seen It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and the meme of Charlie Day? And he's got the red yarn strewn about all over the map. He's trying to piece things together. That's what my brain looked like. That's an inside image of what it kind of looked and felt like. But I have a system for organizing, because it's not just like Zephyrus is very much the lead, but there are seven point of view characters throughout the story, and each one has a full arc. So like trying to get all of them to coincide, both world building wise, like their moral reasoning. I spent a lot of time like going through like psychology textbooks to try to understand like how do people think, what are the like value systems, how are they constructed, when they get damaged, what do they start to look like, and like piecing together internal arcs, external arcs, how these characters coincide with one another, the interpersonal relationships, having all that come out in a timely fashion and having each individual character go through their own individual arc that still connects and coincides. It's not like, oh, everyone's story's here and that person's just kind of over there. Like, I wanted everything to come to a head together. So it was a lot of spreadsheets, a lot of spreadsheets, very, very many sheets of spreadsheets, but color-coded, I might add, to draft. but yeah, it's definitely like I do a lot of working with newer authors, and the big thing that I try to encourage is like, you need to have a system. Some people call it a story Bible. You need to have your means of organization. Otherwise, it's very easy to get lost in the sauce. And I was very lucky to have an editor who took me under their wing and was like, okay, you need organizational skills and I can help you do that. And that was a lifesaver. Otherwise, this whole project probably would have taken 50 years.
Yeah, never doubt the power of a good editor.
Enjoying the podcast? Get even more of the content you love from artists around the world on Citywide Bites. Experience the show live on Saturdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, only on Instagram. With our interactive short-form interview series, you can ask your questions and be a part of the action. Hosted by Max Bowen.
But I want to backtrack a little bit too. You mentioned you had studied psychology during the writing process. What made you want to do that? And how do you think that kind of shaped the book?
So it was not something that I, like, you know, I didn't wake up one day and went, you know what I'm going to do today? I'm going to read some really dry psychology textbooks. It was actually my editor. She was talking about like the moral reasoning and the moral development of a character. And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Talk to me like I'm in first grade. And so she gave me like the broad strokes of, here are Kohlberg's six levels of moral reasoning and moral development. Look it up. And this became a deep dive into like what even is moral reasoning. So very in the most broad scope. So most writers, it's like, okay, here's the character's goal and here's their motivation. Here's what they want. Here's why they want it. Then moral development, moral reasoning is like what goes into their thought process when making that decision. So, for example, what I use to kind of showcase this is why one might lie, right? So of six stages of development, ones and twos are generally very selfish. So ones, someone who's a one level moral reasoner is going to do, they're going to lie if they think they'll get punished if they tell the truth. So it's very self-serving. They don't want punishment. Whereas twos now realize like, if I say the right thing, I might get rewarded. So it's more of there is a positive aspect that they can, like if I behave a certain way, I can get a positive thing. Level threes then start to go a little bit outside of themselves. And it's more social. But that social circle is generally pretty small. Fours then take that level to a bit higher level, and it's more a societal, like social constructs that, like, you know, we have all socially agreed that it is good to have laws in the United States. We drive on the right side of the street because that's what we do and it makes people safe. And everyone pretty much adheres to that. So you obey the rules and you make your decisions because it is in the best, it's best for most people. So the letter of the law. And level fives, however, become, it's now principles. It is the principle of the law. It's not the letter, but like what the spirit of the law. So like you'll tell like a white lie, you know, lying bad. A four would be like, gotta always tell the truth. A five would be like, okay, there's a time and a place to tell a white lie. And like it's better for everyone. And then a level six is kind of like a five, but their universal ethical principles are so well constructed that like they're basically willing to die for those principles. It's at such a high level that they believe in this thing. So having an amnesiac character, you can imagine that like they don't have a lot to really shape their worldview. They don't have the biases, the prejudices, the understanding of social settings and different whatever, what have you, interpersonal relationships to like really drive their decision making. So his character and being the main character, I was all over the place trying to figure out like, how does this guy think? What factors into his decision making? So I had to really study this to be like, okay, if someone doesn't have a real guiding light of principle, how would this develop over time? So throughout the story, as Zephyrus's memories come back, he's able to kind of make decisions on what matters to him more so than someone like, and you'll see this with other characters throughout the story who, you know, they've been brought up and raised and their social expectations that they're trying to adhere to. And maybe it's a social circle, maybe it's the law and order, maybe it's the principles that their family is built on, whatever it is, they're kind of beholden to it. And Zephyrus doesn't really have those attachments. So he's able to, you know, think for himself a little bit more and really find what is important to him when making these decisions. So it was definitely not something I started with the idea of, you know what I need to do today. but I have my editor to thank. She was really fundamental and foundational in all things that made this book possible.
Yeah, we definitely thought the decision to make the main character, Zephyrus, amnesiac, was very interesting and very compelling. Throughout the process of kind of digging into like the psychology of it, did you ever have a second thought of maybe changing the main character and from, you know, going from having no memory to maybe having a memory? Or
Absolutely, because that was it's kind of amnesiacs are kind of a no-no in traditional publishing. It's kind of like, right. It's an immediate like, it's an ick for some people. So like it would have been much easier to just be like, all right, scrap that and let's go back to the drawing board. It's easier to give him memories than not have him have memories. Sure. It would have been so much easier in terms of like, okay, when is the backstory information going to come through? It would have been so much easier. But I liked the idea of like, it's having a character that's learning the world as the reader's learning the world, I think adds, it's a very forgiving entryway when, okay, you're confused, he's confused. You can relate to that. You can bond based on that. And that kind of gives a little bit more of a, it kind of softens the steep learning curve of a lot of epic fantasy books. So like my wife does not read epic fantasy. Like that's not her jam. You know what I mean? So like, I was like, okay, how do I make it so that like this is an easier learning curve to bring people in so that I can get to the stuff that I want to get? And I thought as I was getting more into the psychology of it, I was like, this is too interesting to not do just because it's an ick for some people. Because I understand why it's an ick. It's just like, oh, here we go again. I guess we'll find out later. But like, I wanted like, it's not really his memories that are important. It's that he's a blank slate and he can choose what he wants to be. And it was more that side of being an amnesiac that I found more interesting. Having someone who has quite a bit of ability and power and influence, yet they don't know which direction they're leaning. And, you know, the first book is called The Scales of Balance. So you can imagine like he can tip the scales in either way. And it's just a matter of, well, what do you believe in? What's important to you? What do you value? So while yes, it would have been easier. And there were times where I was like, I really wish I didn't bite off so much. It's a lot to chew. I'm so glad I did. I think this is a, I hope this can serve as a book series, a trilogy that is accessible to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to get into epic fantasy, because it's just like I don't know if you've read like Stormlight Archive by Brandon Sanderson. Like, we got 1,000-page books that have, you know, 300-page compendiums, and it can be a lot. Even though I think they're some of the best books ever written, and I would love for everyone to be able to read it. So I hope my story can serve as almost an entryway for people who are more afraid to enter the big, big scope of epic fantasy, because it can get, it's daunting.
Yeah, for sure. I also was reading up on your background too. And for our listeners too, that may not know this, you have a very interesting background in terms of your kind of like day profession, right? You're a personal trainer, a fitness professional. And one of the things that I found most fascinating about that too, looking into it, is you do a lot of work with a lot of different like gladiator and medieval title like weapons, with maces and clubs and staffs and swords and things like that. So with that work, how did that kind of influence the fight scenes and whatnot in the storytelling with the book?
Yeah, very much so. I've always been like, you know, playing Dungeons and Dragons, my favorite part was combat. You know what I mean? Like, I've always been drawn to that, the concept of the man in the arena. So I played sports my whole life. And this concept of like, you know, be better than the person across from you. And that balance of like, okay, well, what does sportsmanship look like in, you know, fights to the death? And that's something that like, that's not something I've experienced in my athletic career. You know what I mean? So getting to pair the, like trying to emulate that in exercise, and getting to be on the side of like, you know, I train people how to do this. To teach it well, I feel like I need to have done it well. I need to know how it feels. I need to kinesthetically understand. very, and this is like an ick of mine when I'm reading a book, and they're talking about stabbing with like a big curved sword. I was like, well, why would you do that when it's, you know, designed to be slashed and sliced? Why would you stab with it? It's not designed for that. Like, this is a double-edged sword and you're using it like it's a mace. Like, why would you do that? You don't need to rear. Like, there's so many little things like that that are just icks to me. And that most readers aren't going to notice. They're not going to care. But from the sense of authenticity, it definitely gave me like something to just be a nerd about. You know what I mean? Like, to get sucked into and explore. So it like, writing made me go like, okay, I want to get into this. But like, as I got more into that side of like, you know, training with maces and staves and clubs and eventually swords were actually the last thing. But like a lot of the movement and the skill sets, cause it's generally all footwork. a lot of it kind of starts and stems from the same places. So there's like a linear progression almost with the overlap in that skill set. So getting to, like, I think writing this stuff made me like hungrier to explore more movement wise, but then training more movement wise helped me describe these scenes better and kind of really ground them into something that like, I hope readers can like feel that they are the man in the arena in that sense. And that's just something that like, I take a lot of pride in. Like, those moments are really important to me because, once again, like, that's my favorite. That's what I always enjoyed in tabletop games. And that's what I enjoyed in, you know, video games and other books and TV shows, whatever. So getting that right, I felt like if I want to get this right, I can live it to a degree. I don't have to like, okay, so there's, you know, magic in the book. I'm not going to conjure fire. As much as I wish I could, it's not going to happen. But well, like,
you know, not, if I can, not, oh, that attitude, come on. Gotta believe you can do it, Tim. Believe you can do it.
You know, Max, you're 100% right on me for dooming myself. But yeah, I really wanted to give myself every opportunity to narrow the gap of suspended disbelief. If I can experience like, well, what does it feel like to hold a sword in your hand? How heavy is it actually? And what does edge alignment even mean? And like, think about it. So like, if you have a double-edged sword, right, and it cuts, and like, I know this is not a visual media, but you can imagine if I slap with a sword versus cut with a sword, one is going to do significantly more damage than the other. And if it's sharpened and it's steel, and then like, if you're going up against an armored opponent versus an unarmored opponent, like, all of a sudden, these things start to totally change. And once again, nerd. But like, I wanted to kind of bring that stuff to life, and to the point where my editor was like, I understand that. You can do half of that. So as much as it's cool, there's also a degree of, and I'm going to make a pun here, you have to temper that steel in order to bring it to a sharp edge.
That was like three dad like, jokes in one. Good job. Well done.
Nice
well
work.
Done. You know, flexing up. You know, picking up on this, what did you find were some of the biggest like misconceptions people have about like medieval style combat?
I think that it is, it always comes back to what age are we talking and like how much armor is involved and how effective are the weapons that are employed. So in the gladiatorial arena that I've constructed in this world, I wanted to have like, it's kind of on the the bridge of, you know, Gladiatorium is kind of looked at as like for the peasants. It's not like everyone wants to see the knights. Everyone wants to see the tournaments. This is Barbary and this is elevated. This is class. But there's still this, like, you know, they're trying to make it a little more dynamic. So I have like modern versus traditional gladiators, and traditional gladiators, you know, there's very limited armor. It's, you know, it's either leather or it's like very, very much like body. whereas, you know, more of the traditional fighters, they're wearing plate, you know, not full plate mail, but they have like, they're slower because of that. They're going to wield different weapons to target that. And I always liked the concept of like chess, like positioning matters, strategy matters, as opposed to just like, well, give them the best you got. Like, no. If you're in a group melee, like you're going to pick who you're going after based on who you have advantage against. If you have a reach advantage, if you have a mobility advantage, if you have an armor advantage, like you want to leverage your strengths and cover your weaknesses. And I think that, you know, if we're talking about more medieval, like, okay, full on, you know, battles, I really don't have a lot in my story that really have that, because once it gets to that point, there's magic involved, and magic is kind of like a full-on game changer. So it's a, you know, good luck wearing plate against a guy who can wield fire. You know what I mean? Like you're gonna have a bad time. So, but I would say one of the biggest misconceptions I think a novice would have is that weapons break. They do. They're not like indestructible. You can't just like beat the hell out of anything that comes near you. So like that's kind of a recurring theme in the first book, is that like these not taken care of, things fall apart. And it doesn't take a lot to, you know, this is dabbling in spoiler territory, but it doesn't make a lot to make something look good, but feel flimsy. And that is something that, like, I was like, would this actually happen? Could this happen? Could like this sword just break? Yeah, swords broke all the time. especially misused, mismanaged. So that was something that, like, I was like, this is a cool little tidbit that I didn't know before I started researching.
Picture this. You finished your first book and nailed it. The plot, the characters, all the twists and turns. This one's a winner, and all you need is the right cover. If you've got my art skills, this is the part where panic usually sets in. Enter the cover villain. Hero to writers everywhere. Founded by noted author Remy Flagg, Cover Villain focuses on composite image covers for science fiction and fantasy writers. Give them the details, and they'll craft a cover using popular trends that everyone will want to see. But wait, you say, I've got ideas of my own. No problem, as Cover Villain loves a good collaboration. As they say, our goal is to put a little villain in every cover we make. Want to know more? Then head to covervillain.com and follow them on Facebook and Instagram. So we've talked about the research, but I want to talk about the writing. Now, what got you into writing in the first place? Because this series is your debut. This is your entry into the world of writing yourself. What made you say, hey, it's time for me to actually, you know, pick up a proverbial pen and start working?
So it's a great question. And I think, you know, sometimes when you know, like, I got a good answer for this. Like, I think I have a good answer for this. So I was in a band. I was in a pop punk band in college, and I wrote the lyrics, and me and my roommate, we like wrote the songs together, and like he was the musical talent and I was just the, you know, I'll corral him and together we'll make something happen. And it's just like, okay, well, how would this work? So eventually the band broke up and I didn't feel I had the musical ability to do things on my own, to take my thoughts my thought child and turn them into like real life. So I wanted something that I thought, A, I'd be able to do on my own. B, it would be cheap. And C, it would be something I wouldn't need any help with. Well, I was wrong on all of those fronts. It was not cheap. It did not, I couldn't do it by myself. But like, that's what kind of started me on the writing journey. I was training in the city at the time. I was working like 80 hours a week. And I was like standing up, falling asleep. And one of my clients was like, "You look really tired." I'm like, "Yeah, I didn't get like any sleep last night. I only slept in 4-hour blocks at that point." It was literally like, first I'd work from like 5 to like 10 or 11 in the morning. I'd go home. I'd sleep for a couple hours. I'd come back. I'd work from like 5 to 10 at night and repeat. So it was awful. I would not recommend it to anybody, but like my client's like, "You look really tired." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm having crazy dreams." And she was like, "Are you like a creative person?" I was like, "I guess, I don't know." you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I guess I'm not writing music anymore. And she's like, "Oh, that's probably just your creativity needing a medium to be explored." So I was like, "Okay, I'll start writing." And that was a long time ago now. That was 2011. So like I started with a project and I hated it. So I was like, "Ah, no, this isn't it." But then this was, Eventful Realm was, the second thing that I applied myself to. And there were many times I wanted to stop and many times I wanted to, you know, try something easier. And, but it just, this story just kind of hung with me and it mattered too much to let it go.
I can tell that this was really a passion project for you, because not only are you kind of like living the lifestyle, but you spent a lot of time just like building the world and crafting the characters and then just like boom, 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 book one, book two, book three in 6 months. I'm curious about why go that route, because you know, some authors, they'll do like book one and then like a couple, 3 years later, it's book two and so forth. But you did the, like the fast forward route.
Yes. The unconventional. so there were a couple reasons why. One was, so I had a traditional publishing contract in my hands, in December of 2020. It was a small press. They, wanted to publish the book. They wanted to buy the full trilogy. And I had the contract in hand. Book one was obviously written at that point. I had ideas for book two. But it had taken me quite a bit of time. You know, it was like 6-7 years to get book one done. And now I had, okay, you have a 2-year delivery date to get book two done. And then a 2-year delivery date to get book three done. And I was like, and 2 years is a very generous deadline. But to me, I was like, I don't know if I can do that. I you know, working full time, and that started this whole cascade of like, you know, why am I doing this? And what is more important to me? And the creative process, like, because we have to separate the creative process and what is best for creative integrity versus what is the best business practice. And the best business practice is you write a book, you sell the book. If the book sells well, continue it. If it doesn't, start something new. But that to me, like, I had a trilogy in my head. So either way, if book one didn't do well and they were like, "We're going to pull the plug," or, you know, like, "Yeah, but I'm going to write this anyway. Like, it's in my brain box. I got to put it somewhere." So that from a creative integrity standpoint was important to me. But then I started exploring, well, what would this look like? And the beginning can be so much more impactful if you're beginning with the end in mind. So then the concept of, okay, I'm going to write book one, I'm going to write book two, I'm going to write book three, and then I'm going to go back and I'm going to edit book one to make sure I'm pointing and planting the seeds and the Easter eggs that, you know, you might not even pick up on a first read, but if you go back on a second read, you're like, "Oh my God, it was here from the beginning." Like, I wanted all of those little Easter eggs and nuggets and, you know, like you said, this was very much a passion project. So maybe you've noticed I have perfectionist tendencies that so like, no way, right? Yeah. So trying to incorporate these things in, it just made the most sense from a creative integrity standpoint. Would I do that for future novels and future series? I don't know. Would I recommend other people do it? Probably not. Because once again, like it really depends on, you know, your lifestyle. Like now, you know, I own my own fitness business. I have the time and the flexibility to earn a decent dollar per hour so I can earn enough to support myself, but also have the time and energy to do what I'm passionate about. And that works for me. I'm very privileged and very blessed to be able to say that. That is not the case for a lot of creatives and a lot of writers. So I would never like say like, this is the way you got to do it for the artistic integrity. Like it worked for me. And I'm very fortunate that I was able to do it this way. And I couldn't be happier with how it came out, but would I recommend it? The last 6 months have been an absolute blur. It can be a lot. So I think there's a lot of paths to publication, and it's just a matter of finding which one makes the most sense for you professionally, which one makes the most sense for you creatively. And then also like life doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, it's not like you can just compartmentalize and say, this is my writing life and this is my family life and this is my professional life. And so how do all those things intermix? And, you know, you can probably see I've made a spreadsheet to, I'm just kidding. I'm not that crazy, but, it's just finding what is the right balance to make it all work.
And of course, there's reviews. This is also a very essential part for any writer. You want the reviews. You want those 5 stars. You want the 1 stars. Whatever. You know, you want people to give you feedback. And your books have gotten a ton of reviews. So, 2-part question. 1, do you actually read reviews? And 2, if you do, what kind of impact do they have on you?
Great question. And this is like, I feel like so many writers have like such polar opposites on this. I do read reviews. I think it is, because to me, it's a matter of, I want to connect with readers. I think it's important. Like you can say whatever you want. I have 1-star reviews. I don't think they're right, but, but you know what I mean? Like it didn't land for you and that's fine. I'm sure there's books out there that do. There are plenty of books that I read, you know, because authors are readers too. Like when, I read books and they come highly recommended, you know, Book Talk is talking all about this book and I read it and I went, well, that's okay, I guess, not for me. And that's okay. So I think for me, I use it as an opportunity to, if you loved this book, I'm so happy for you. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. I want to add to that experience for you, you know, like, I think it like, I was at WonderCon in LA this past weekend. And I got to meet Hugh Howie, who's the author of Wool and, you know, the show on Apple TV, Silo. And like the nicest guy on planet Earth, like super humble, super down to earth. And like I came up and said, like, I love your work. I love how like you've approached your creativity and the industry as a whole. And, you know, you've advocated for other authors and, like, just thank you. Like, it's so cool what you do. And he was like, when I say just like, it looked like it made him melt. Like he genuinely appreciated what I was saying. And that made it even more significant to me. And I think that like, if you close yourself off to reviews, you're probably doing it to defend yourself. Which I get, like, it does not feel good when someone says, yeah, that book baby that you've spent 10 years in gestation bringing to term. I didn't like it. I don't like your kid. It's like, you know, that's what it feels like. So it's like, okay, well, but at the same time, I don't care. There's a, like, if everyone felt that way, I'd probably be upset. But the fact that there are people out there who do love it, who do resonate with it, who do enjoy it. And, like, I had one reader who was, you know, book three hasn't come out yet, obviously, but like she had an early copy and she read it and, she was like, I just finished. And, you know, her thing was most books, most fiction books don't make you a better person, but I think this book is going to make me a better person. And that just like blew my mind. Like, that's crazy. I am questioning how good of a person you are, but you know what I mean? Like there's, I think if you do engage, with readers, with reviewers, it gives an opportunity for community. And I think that is really what it's all about, bringing people together. So for me, if you write on my Goodreads and you liked it, I'm probably going to respond and say, thank you so much. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And if you want to continue to engage, that's great. Like I'm on social media. I try to, like, I want to be accessible. So that's my take on it. This might sound weird. I don't believe in, like, I don't, on my socials, like, I don't really talk about, like, I don't give reviews for the stuff that, publicly, because unless I love it. And the reason for that is I don't really think there's much of a need for one-star reviews. If people love something, they'll talk about it. If you don't like something, just don't talk about it. And then it'll just kind of, you know, no one will talk about it. Obscurity is worse than one-star reviews. Because like if someone's saying, oh, this book is terrible, you'll hate it. And then it's like, well, now I'm kind of curious. You know what I mean? So I think we did, like, when people start review bombing or slamming an author's work, like, who's this for? If usually, you know, like a third of the way through the book, like, is this your book? Just put it down if you don't like it. Move on. Make you find something that does make you happy. There's so many books out there. Find something that makes you happy. Find a community you want to connect with. Like, I think everyone is searching for that. So find the books that bring you life. That's my whole thing.
Hey, this is singer-songwriter and mental health advocate Stephanie Mathias. Be sure to check out my single Hero Side, available on all platforms now, and listen to Citywide Blackout, your home for the best indie artists.
Yes. So speaking of social media and being on the internet, you know, you have a very strong social media presence, both in, from what I've seen from the books and also, you know, from the fitness business too. How do you do it? How do you manage to juggle all of the things that you've got going on and still maintain such a great social media presence? Because it's one of the things that I find that kind of, not everybody lacks, but there's definitely not as much focus on, which is very important, especially in this day and age.
Well, first of all, Kurt, thank you so much for saying that, because it doesn't feel like I have a great social media presence. So hearing that, that's great. It's definitely hard. I will say that since book two has come out, I've been much less active on social. And that's just because, like, I'm trying to juggle. And from my, like, once again, life doesn't happen in compartments. It's not in a vacuum. And there is a degree of, you know, what bucket am I pouring into? There's only so much me energy I have to give. And what are my before anything else's, and then prioritize the whole way down. So, social media posting, content creation to me is very like, ugh. Like I have to gear up for it. But like engaging with other authors and like, getting to talk, like I'm really like some of the authors I've been able to connect with, some of the readers I've been able to connect with, like I love that part. So I think for me, I really, the content wise, I spent about a year and I tried to post minimum like 5 days a week, 2 to 3 times a day. That was my goal. And I've built this backlog basically. Like if you find me, I have a persona on the internet if you so wish to, you know, click on stuff. So I think that creates a degree of like credibility. I do respond. So if someone reaches out, I can engage. And I think that's half the battle, is just showing like I have enough of a web presence that I can be connected to, as opposed to feeling the need, like, if I don't post every day, I'm failing, which is something that, like, a lot of authors that, like, that is like a thing. Like, it's like, how am I supposed to do it all? And, like, you kind of nail on the head of there's a lot going on, and it is the most, like, when you think about business, right? Like, is it a revenue generating thing? And it's very debatable as to whether it is a revenue generating thing versus if I do not write, there's like, that's the means, that is the base operation. So, and then once again, I have a full-time job. I have a wife. I have, I have friends and relationships I want to maintain, and all of those things do come first. But balance, I'm going to make another pun. Like, the scales of balance was very much something that, like, I struggled with. I told you, like 10 plus years ago, I was working 80 hours a week. I had no balance. It was all work all the time. And I felt it. It wasn't a good space. It wasn't healthy. So I feel like I have started to balance my own scales. And thematically, this story is about, like, kind of course correcting when you realize you're going one way and blindly too. Like, you're believing a lie and taking it, like, full magnitude. So that's something that was very important to me. It's definitely not easy. I know a lot of people who struggle with it. I myself still have moments of struggling with it. Like, I'm going to do the best I can when I can. And, if something has to, you know, fall off, it usually is going to be content creation. But I made a commitment of that first year, I'm going to post, you know, 2 to 3 times a day, 5 days a week. And I did it. And that has built enough of a community that when I do post, there are people that engage with it. And that's excellent. That's awesome. That it feels great to have those relationships that were established during that time. And when things like we just finished recording the third audiobook. So it's like just got uploaded to Audible. It'll go through their 10 business day review cycle and whatnot. So just in time, but that frees up. I was, you know, Landon Solberg, my narrator, he allows me into the recording booth with him, so to speak. Like, we get on a Zoom call and I watch him read. I kind of get to direct. But that is, like, you know, 10 hours a week. Like, it's, it adds up. And that's 10 hours a week that's taking away from things like writing, things like, my work. I still manage, you know, I have control over my schedule. I can make that happen. But content creation is the first thing that goes. So I'm hoping to get back into that, especially since I do have a pretty big release coming up. So I should be on and pushing that. So that, but thank you for saying that I have a web presence. I actually do zero for fitness now. I do not promote my fitness business at all, which is also, like, great. I never really had a passion for connecting with that community other than getting clients. So if anyone wants to learn how to swing swords and have, like, a fantasy themed workout, yeah, then hit me up. Yeah, there we go.
Well, Max is waving. There you go.
That's what I want at this point in my career. So, and we can talk about books and nerd things. That's what I want.
Dude, sign me up.
There we go.
I'm down with this shit. All right. Well, folks, we are coming down to the end of this conversation. But before we wrap things up, of course, the ever important question, Tim, is what's next?
Okay. I'm very excited. I have I've started building this next world. I'm kind of pitching it as, like, a Peaky Blinders meets, like, Peaky Blinders in a Ludus. And so there's definitely going to be that gladiator vibe again. It's going to almost feel like the Mediterranean, in which there are all of these very different cultures surrounding that it's geographically separated, but instead of it being by water, it's going to be by this miasma, this cataclysm that every 10 years kind of renews itself. And there's lore and, you know, some theological beliefs as to why, but every 10 or so years, the mission is just containing it. It's going to start up again. We have to contain it. And, you know, the magic system is a combination of, it's based on the arts, and that's cross-referenced with the different forms of wellness. So it's like physical wellness, mental wellness, social wellness. I have all of these different components that are kind of, you can imagine this spreadsheet, it's going to be a big one. So I'm really excited for this story. The plan for this is to have, a three book arc that follows three characters. And for that to almost open into a secondary trilogy that takes place immediately following the events of this first trilogy, but it's going to be much bigger in scope. Instead of three characters, it's probably going to be 7 to 10. The books are going to be longer, and it's all going to lead to one big epic conclusion. So I've just started plotting out not just the first book, but the first trilogy. The hope would be I want to have every character arc for all six books mapped out before I begin writing this first book of the first trilogy. This won't be in the same world as A Vengeful Realm. But because you've already seen that I'm a little crazy, that doesn't mean that it won't have tie-ins. But I won't know that for sure until I've plotted it all out. Because if I'm opening up I love the Avengeful Realm ending. I love it. So to open it back up, I need to know with certainty that I'm going to open it up and have a better ending. If I can't outdo myself, I'm just going to let it lie and move on to the next thing. So that's what's next for me.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, folks, you can check out everything we've just talked about. All three books, the Vengeful Realm series, The Scales of Balance Part 1, The Breaker of Chains, The Age of the End, out April 16th. So definitely pre-order right now. Get your copy. Leave reviews. He loves reviews.
Yes, please.
And check everything out at timfaciola.com. That's Tim, FACCIOLA.com. It's all there. Follow his socials. Even if he's not updating, just follow him anyway. He likes that stuff. And of course, Tim, thank you once again for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm sure we shall be talking again very soon.
Max, Curtis, thank you guys so much for having me on. This was an absolute pleasure and a lot of fun. So thank you so much.
And with that, we bring this episode to a close. Thanks for listening, and if you haven't already, check us out on Facebook under Citywide Blackout, and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. You can catch this and all your favorite episodes on your favorite podcast platform, and new episodes are added every week, as well as on Boston Free Radio every Saturday at 10 p.m. You get at me at citywidemax@yahoo.com if you want us just a guest, submit your music, or just drop us a line. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.